Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast dedicated to critiquing diet and wellness culture and answering your questions about intuitive eating and the anti-diet approach. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm a registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, journalist, and author of the books Anti-Diet, The Wellness Trap, and the new Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, which are all available wherever you get your books or at ChristyHarrison.com/books. That's ChristyHarrison.com/books. And by the way, on this show, we avoid diet culture details like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there. Welcome to this episode of Food Psych. I'm Christy, and today I'm talking with eating disorders therapist Shira Rosenbluth, who returns for her second appearance on the pod to discuss how she was able to get into solid eating disorder recovery after many years of struggling, including when she came on for her first Food Psych interview in 2019, her experience of recovering into a larger body, and how she navigated weight stigma in that process, being a plus-size bride and everything that goes with that, how the hype around GLP-1s has affected her recovery and that of her clients, and lots more. This was a great conversation. I can't wait to share it with you. First, I want to let you know about some resources you might find helpful, one of which is Intuitive Eating Fundamentals, the online course I created to help you make peace with food. The course teaches you how to recognize and reject diet culture, take pleasure in food and stop fighting your desires, tune back into your body's signals of hunger and fullness, end the restrict rebound cycle or restrict binge cycle, navigate emotional eating and learn new coping skills, and most importantly, I think, avoid turning intuitive eating into a sneaky new diet. I've been running this course and adding to it consistently since 2016, so there's a huge wealth of content in it, hundreds of hours on the principles of intuitive eating, deep dives into how to handle common things that come up when you're trying to make peace with food, and a live monthly Q&A to help answer all your burning questions. This cohort also includes a special members-only forum so that you can connect with others and support each other through the course, and alumni get access to future forums as well. Learn more and sign up at ChristyHarrison.com/course. That's ChristyHarrison.com/course. Since you're listening to this podcast, I have a couple of books I think you might appreciate, including my first one, Anti-Diet, which was based on and extended on the first 8 or 9 seasons, I think, of this podcast. And then my newest book, which is called The Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook. I co-authored the workbook with therapists Judith Matz and Amy Pershing, who are longtime leaders in the field of diet culture recovery, binge eating disorder, and trauma-informed care, who've both been on this show multiple times before, including earlier this season, to talk about the book. We teamed up to create a workbook for both clinicians and general readers that we hope will help you break free from the diet binge or restrict rebound cycle, recognize sneaky diets disguised as wellness plans, better understand the role that food plays in your life and in managing emotions, unlearn harmful messages about when and what you're quote-unquote supposed to eat, dispel myths about weight, health, and fitness, and lots more. If any of that sounds interesting or helpful to you, you can learn more and buy the book at ChristyHarrison.com/workbook or click the link in the show notes. And now, without any further ado, here's my conversation with Shira Rosenbluth. So Shira, welcome back to Food Psych. I'm so excited to talk with you again.
It's so good to be back.
You were last on the podcast a million years ago, like in such a different time, right? It was 2019 before everything. And at the time you were struggling with your own eating disorder and, you know, just the sort of fraught nature of going through that personally while also being an eating disorder therapist. And I really appreciated what you shared on the podcast. And I think a lot of people did, you know, the bravery of opening up about that while going through it is pretty amazing. And now your life is so different and it seems like you're in such a better place. So can you catch us up on what's happened for you over those years and how you've, you know, solidified your recovery in that time?
Yeah, it's funny because I don't think back in 2019, if you would have told me that I'd be here today, I would have been so confused and probably not believed you because I felt, you know, so stuck at that point. But I think so what was happening was I kept going back to treatment and continue to face weight stigma, continue to not be able to be allowed to eat enough in treatment when I was very, very malnourished, but I wasn't, you know, quote unquote, underweight according to the garbage BMI standards. And so I wasn't being fed the way I needed to. My brain was not getting like the nutrition just on that level. And then also, of course, getting the constant weight stigma comments from nurses and even my clinicians and everyone around me in treatment. I was getting sicker and sicker. And even when I wasn't getting like full on weight stigma, depending on the center I was in, I felt like I was just in treatment, getting sicker and sicker. And so I got to the point where I finally found a really good therapist. And I think I'm pretty sure that the head of the program basically was going to tell me I needed to go to a higher level of care or I was out. And if she would have framed it that way, I probably would have said, okay, I'm going home. And I don't know if I'd be here today, to be honest, like considering where I was. But my therapist told her to ask me what I wanted and what I needed, which nobody had asked me in my entire eating disorder journey. And so I said, what I do know is that treatment is not helping me right now. And that's not to say treatment's not helpful for a lot of people, but for me at that time, it just wasn't. And I said, I think I just need to stay with a friend and just have support and be in a less like sterile, like kind of like treatment environment. And so I did that. I moved in with a friend and a colleague, and she was incredible and helped support me for 2 months. And then I went home back to a pretty chaotic environment, and then COVID happened. So there was definitely bumps in the road. It wasn't smooth, right? It wasn't like, oh, I went to this person's house and then I was cured. But that was really the start of my recovery, because for the first time in my life, I didn't have people that were afraid of my hunger. I didn't have people that were afraid of my body. It was very much like, we trust your body. Your body's going to do whatever it needs to do. And you just need to eat. Like, that's what you need to do. And so I like was in a loving environment. I was in a weight stigma free environment for the first time in my life, where everyone around me trusted my body, which I had never experienced before. And it really gave me the opportunity to get to this place where I'm so much more free. And it's been an incredible few years for me.
That's really amazing. And I know everybody's journey is different. And some people find tremendous relief from treatment centers and, you know, traditional treatment. And I've known many others who have struggled with that. And especially, I think, you know, people with longstanding eating disorders like yours was, and also people who are recovering into a higher weight body and the weight stigma that comes along with that. So can you share a little bit about what that was like, the experience of recovering into a larger body, and how you navigated the weight stigma that was coming up, and, you know, not just in treatment environments, but also when sharing your journey on social media and within your family and sort of in real life as well?
Yeah. I mean, I came home to parents that said to me, do you think that they fed you too much? And so that was kind of my like first awakening back home. And so that's why I say it wasn't like smooth sailing when I got home. I definitely had a couple more like lapses and bumps, and it was really rough because, again, I'm living in this environment where people are essentially telling me to go back to my eating disorder. It was really hard when my body started getting bigger and probably the biggest I've ever been. And so, but I was eating what I needed to eat, and this is where my body wants to be. But like, I couldn't comfortably like sit in an airplane seat anymore. And I lost access to clothes, which was like, you know, clothes are not everything, but it is, was a part of like how I expressed myself. And honestly, I'm no longer able to do that in the way that I used to. And so losing all of the thin privilege that I had felt and feels awful a lot of the time. And I think people say to me, like, would you still choose recovery if you knew that you'd be in this body? And my answer is, but I had no other alternative. Like, of course I would, because I have a life. I would have been thin, and I would have had thin privilege, and I would have fit into society better and avoided a lot of stigma. But I also, first of all, probably would be dead. And also, even if I wasn't dead, my entire life would be completely consumed by my eating disorder and exercise and calories and numbers and scales and weight. And I wouldn't be able to go out with my friends. I wouldn't be able to do like holiday meals or Shabbat dinners or literally anything that could potentially involve food. I'd put my eating disorder before anything, including like an exercising before anything. My entire life would revolve around my eating disorder. So yeah, I would have thin privilege and I'd benefit from that, but at the cost of my happiness, my peace, and my life. So it's interesting because I think, you know, whenever I talk to other providers, the first question is like, well, how did you get to this place where you love your body now? And I'm always like, I don't love my body now. Like, it is what it is. Like, this is my body. Like, it's hard to love my body all the time in a society that tells me it's wrong. and that I'm wrong every single day. And I also can have compassion for my body, and I can treat it well, regardless of body image struggles that I experience, depending on the day. And so it's not that I necessarily love my body all the time. It's more that I know that I have a lot more value than just my size. And it's just, this is the body that's keeping me alive and letting me live a life that I never dreamed I could live.
I love that. And it really speaks to when you first came on the podcast, it was for a series I was doing about how diet culture is a life thief and all the ways it steals your life. And, you know, it was based on my book, Anti-Diet, which the subtitle is Reclaim Your Time, Money, Well-Being, and Happiness. And, you know, because diet culture takes away those things, right? And I outline in the book how diet culture steals each one of those things and more from us. And you are in the section on money, because we were talking about treatment and treatment centers and, you know, just inordinate amounts of money that you had to spend to sort of claw your life back from diet culture. But it's so interesting to talk to you now and sort of see you on the other side of this and how much more life is available to you and in all the ways, you know, it's the time, the money, the well-being, the happiness, the joy, the connection, all of that. It's pretty cool to circle back and see the life that recovery has given you, really.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, I'll notice small little things that other people probably take for granted when it comes to just my freedom around food. And they're really small and subtle, you know, I'll grab a big bag of, I don't know, pretzels and eat from the bag or something, and then realize I don't count them anymore, right? Or I'm not portioning it out in a very specific way. I'm just eating freely. And they're just they're small examples, but they are really meaningful when I notice them, because I think when you're in the depths of just the fighting of recovery, where it's just constant exhaustion and hard work, and you're it's never going to get easier. Oh my God, it's going to feel this way forever. I think that recovery happens so slowly that it's sometimes hard to see your progress. And so just realizing those little moments where I'm no, I've come so, so far, and the not so little moments, that it's really cool to experience. Yeah, the freedom that I have, and even, you know, the relationship that I'm in, and I'm getting married soon, and I don't think I could have been in a relationship with somebody else because I was fully in a relationship with my eating disorder before.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about that piece of relational recovery, I guess, and how the eating disorder started to take up less space and give you more room for someone else in your life. Was there sort of a moment when you were I'm ready to date, or, you know, I'm ready to have a relationship, or was it kind of a slow build?
I think it was more of a slow build. I don't think there was one day where I was no, I'm not ready. And the next day I suddenly was. But I think, you know, I was already in recovery when I came out as queer. But I think that if I was still sick, I don't know if I would have been able to have the courage to do that. And so I think being able to come out and also, you know, make my settings on the apps to see a variety of different people. I don't think I ever would have dated a woman before, and it was never an option. I also grew up ultra Orthodox, where I didn't even know that being queer was even a possibility. I didn't even know that was a thing, right? Because I was so sheltered. And so, yeah, just I think a lot of it was moving away from the ultra, ultra Orthodox upbringing that I grew up around, and moving across the country and getting to be more of myself and getting to really sit with my recovery and continued freedom from my eating disorder, having more time, right? I just had more time. I wasn't spending all of my time engaging in my eating disorder. I also wasn't terrified to eat. And so I could go out to a restaurant. I didn't have to sit there and freak out about it for an entire week beforehand and plan every single thing that I might or might not order and how to get away with restricting and, you know, all of that. I was just able to just be and be more flexible. And I think having the time, having the flexibility, all of that helped me be more open to all of that in a relationship. Because if I did try to enter a relationship, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to eat with them. I wouldn't have been able to do a lot of things with them. And I probably would have made a lot of excuses of why I couldn't see them at certain times. But yeah, I think, you know, I was on the apps and then I met somebody and I had more time and more flexibility and I just went with it.
I love that sort of idea of just you had more space for intimacy in your life, really. You had more ability to share who you really were and not have to hide and not have to, you know, share your time or split your time with the person with the eating disorder, you know, not to have to be sort of pulled between two poles.
Right. And, you know, even when I have moments where body image is rough or maybe the noise gets a little loud for a second because that's real life recovery. Mm-hmm. But I have a partner that's really supportive. And also, I think, you know, before I met her, I had a lot of anxiety about what she would think when she saw me in real life and saw my body. And, you know, because a lot of people in larger bodies are scared to date and scared of the waist stigma they might encounter. But I met someone who loves me as I am. And because of that, it was easy for me to feel safe in our relationship because I knew that my body was fine with her. Mm. And so I think that also helped a lot.
That's huge. And that's like such a gift and sometimes too rare to find, especially on the apps.
Oh, don't worry. I, before that, went on one date with somebody who was currently doing the keto diet at the time. So,
oh boy. Oh yeah.
That was one date. Then yeah. I met Becky. So yeah.
Okay, good. So it wasn't too long to be spending in that purgatory.
No.
I'm curious to hear more about like this journey of coming out and how it perhaps relates to your eating disorder. I know that there's some talk and maybe some, you know, scientific literature as well about like people who are struggling with their sexual identity or gender identity or whatever, you know, any sort of identity. Sometimes the eating disorder can be kind of a coping mechanism for that, right? And a way to like deal with negative emotions about yourself and self-criticism and to sort of like shrink yourself to fit into a box, you know? And I'm curious if that resonates for you at all, or if you feel your eating disorder play that role.
Well, I do think, I mean, I remember thinking like, maybe I can just try harder to be straight, or I can just like hide that part of myself, or like, I could marry a guy, it'll be fine. Like I can do it. And just, I remember, okay, this is actually really interesting, but back in my eating disorder, I ate a lot of vegetables. And my dietitian at the time said, I think for you, men are like the broccoli and egg whites of your eating disorder. Like you could do it, but like, it's not going to give you a full thriving life. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of joking around when he said it, but I was like, wait, that's actually so true. I could do it, but it's not really like what I fully want right now. And it's not going to give me maybe the life where like I feel passion and excitement and love and joy. And so maybe I do want to try dating women. So it was the way that he phrased that. It was kind of funny, but also it was kind of like a small aha moment for me. Mm-hmm. And I do think, similar to what we were talking about before, I didn't have space to even consider anything else when I was in my eating disorder because I was so consumed by it. So of course I wasn't thinking about my sexuality or my identity or anything like that because my entire identity was wrapped in my eating disorder. So when I started recovery, I had more space and more time to think about my sexuality, to think about my wants and relationship needs. And I think that's when I slowly started realizing that I might be queer. Like, yeah, so I think in the way of like it giving me more space in my recovery was what allowed me to explore my identity.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
You recently got engaged, as you mentioned, and I'm so excited for you. Congratulations.
Thank
awesome.
You.
You've started to write about like the ups and downs of being a plus size bride, and I'd love to get into some of that today. What has been the most challenging part of that for you?
I think the entire industry of like the entire bridal industry is fully, you know, you hear these horrible terms, shedding for the wedding and all these other things. And then you come to the bridal shops to try on your dress. And for me, at least, I realized that I had 1/100th of the options that thin people get to have in terms of their dresses. And I, you know, I could have spent thousands and thousands of dollars to customize maybe a dress for me, but I didn't have that kind of money. And so I had to go with like a dress that was ready made. And so I did feel a lot of grief knowing that like I had two stores in the entire California to go to.
Oh, wow.
That had my size when, you know, other brides can go to like 50 or 80 or I don't know, you know, I'm making up a number, but significantly more. And I also like there was a couple of styles that I absolutely loved that like were my dream. And again, people sometimes dream of their wedding day and want to feel like they're wearing the dress that they love. And I feel like I did have to settle a little, to be honest. And that was really, really hard. And again, I keep reminding myself that nothing is worth going back to my eating disorder for. Like I could look the way I may have envisioned on my wedding day and the dress that I wanted to wear at the cost of everything. And like making myself and my fiance miserable because my entire life would be consumed by that again. So whenever I have those that like pull to like go back because of the weight stigma I'm facing, I really just try to remind myself that it would come at the cost of everything and it wouldn't be worth it. But yeah, so just really dealing with like the bridal industry and how obsessed it is with like dieting and being smaller. And I think the other thing is bridal dresses come about two sizes smaller. And so I had even less options because my size was bigger, which that's fine. Like, you know, the size is just a number. That's not the thing that freaked me out. The thing that freaked me out was that gave me even less options, right? Mm-hmm. So all of that was a lot to wrap my head around. At the end of the day, I did find a bridal shop that where the woman herself was in, you know, somewhat of a larger body, and she was lovely and did not talk about weight at all and made my experience so much better than it could have been, which is why I got a dress at her store. And I do, you know, I like the dress. It wouldn't have been my number one option.
Yeah. I love that what you're saying though about like this idea of just weighing what it's worth to you to have that dream dress or to look the way you'd envision versus what you'd have to give up in your recovery and in your relationship and your ability to be free and enjoy your life and have all that life available to you. I think about that a lot too when people ask about like how can recovery be worth it or is it really possible and like what does that look like and you know what does it look like to sustain recovery long term. And I think it's for me and for many people I've talked to, and it seems like maybe for you too, there's this like sort of constant reminder, I think that I do for myself of like, what's this really worth to me? You know, like, do I really care about wearing this thing? Do I really care about this cellulite or whatever, you know, whatever it might be that I'm obsessing about or having a moment with, you know, with my body image. And at the end of the day, it's like, no, I care so much more about my life and all the things that have come with that, that I also know I wouldn't have if I had stayed in my eating disorder and continued to punish myself in the way that I used to and continue to make myself, you know, cut myself off from the world and sort of not allow people in because the eating disorder took up so much space in my life.
Right. And honestly, like, I think something that's been like nice for me in the work that I do is to be able to, you know, I have clients in larger bodies or clients that potentially should be in larger bodies, but they're restricting or whatever it might be. And they have an example of somebody like living in a fat body and living their life and having a full life. And that's like what I needed to see when I was sick. I needed to see fat people like having a full life and living and living joyfully. And so now I get to do that for other people. And it feels really nice to be able to do that.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think that is so powerful to give that model to people who don't have that in their lives and to show that recovery is worth it. Because you said, I've seen you write on Instagram and stuff that like people ask you that question a fair amount. They're like, is it really worth it? And, you know, I think probably some of the impetus for that question is coming from fear around having to deal with weight stigma, I can imagine, right? Like fear of recovering into a larger body and having the world not be hospitable to you and not be made for you and like all the pain that comes along with that, which is so real, right? And there's still so much more value in your life and in the things that you get with recovery.
Right. And I do think that there's something to be said about when you're more fed and nourished, you can get through harder things like with a little bit more resilience than if you were really undernourished and hungry and spending all of your time consumed by your eating disorder. That's not to say that I want us to have to be resilient to hard things, but it's just the reality of being more nourished.
Yeah, that's a great point because I think people who are asking that question are probably in an eating disorder space and in that sort of mind space. It's hard to imagine not being so consumed by those thoughts and not having it be the end of the world, you know, that you experience weight stigma, which, yeah, as you said, like nobody should have to. And it's terrible. And we need to change society to, you know, make weight stigma a thing of the past. And when you're in that nourished state and you can be more resilient, it's probably not going to look as terrible as it does through that lens of eating disorder.
Yeah. And I don't think I would have believed that I could have gotten through some of the things that I've gotten through in the last couple of years and stayed in recovery. I think when I was sick, I thought that would immediately send me into a relapse. And I can't predict what, you know, the rest of my life is going to look like. But I do know that I've experienced, even in the last year, some really hard medical stuff that have happened. And, you know, of course, my brain is like, is it because of my size? And then realizing that it really had nothing to do with my size and everything to do with so many other things. But then I experienced just, you know, hard situations at doctor's offices and weight stigma, trying to get care. And I think in the past, I assumed it would derail me. And while that was really hard, and I had to do a lot of, you know, just grieving around it and talking about it in my own therapy, I also was able to handle it and still stay in my recovery. So I think that when we actually have to experience like whatever we're experiencing in our bodies, we can experience a lot more than we think we can sometimes.
That's really powerful. You've written that you have sort of avoided going to the doctor at times because of that weight stigma. Can you share a little bit about like how you are dealing with the doctor now and how what sort of strategies are helping you navigate that?
Yeah. So I was experiencing, a lot of GI issues and gastroparesis, and I wish I'd gone to the doctor sooner. But also at the same time, I understand why I didn't. I didn't want to face weight stigma, and that makes so much sense. But I am so incredibly lucky to have a health at every size or weight inclusive doctor, I should say. And so I know that's not something that everyone gets to have. And I'll explain something that I think could be helpful. But for me, she would call any specialist that I was supposed to see and kind of vet them out a little bit. And like, so for example, she'll say, you know, please, like, this person's in recovery from an eating disorder. Please don't weigh her or talk about her weight or blame her body for any of her issues. And if there's anything in regards to food that needs to be a conversation, please let me know and we'll have that conversation. And so if that person, if the doctor comes back and has some really intense reaction to that, then my doctor knows, okay, maybe it's someone you need to avoid. But if they're like, okay, then at least I know that person's open, right? And like willing. Are they going to be perfect? Probably not. But it gives me, it saves me from a lot of really potentially horrible situations. So that has been a huge thing that's been helpful for every doctor that I go to. Because at the end of the day, I do this for my clients, right? But like nobody in the position of going to a doctor should have to be their own advocate when it's really hard, when there's already these like hard power dynamics involved. So I'm so lucky to have a doctor that does it for me. And I think if someone doesn't have a weight inclusive doctor, because I know they're hard to come by and it breaks my heart that everyone can't experience like a doctor that I have, then have, if you have a therapist or if you have an like a friend that could be an advocate, like have somebody call before and just kind of do a little vetting so that you could potentially decrease your experiences of weight stigma if you can, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that is so helpful. How did you find your doctor in the first place?
Probably from word of mouth and maybe even my therapist, or like the doctor that I have is in Seattle, but she's licensed in California, so I'm able to see her, which is incredible.
It's huge.
And so, yeah, I think like she just, people know her in the community because she is so hard to come by and I'm assuming gets a lot of referrals. So yeah, I got really lucky.
I mean, if you're comfortable sharing, maybe we can put her info in the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's Dr. Lily Stokely at One Connection Healthcare. And I honestly fully believe that anyone that works for her is safe. I know that she does an amazing job of educating and making sure that everyone that works for her is on the same page. So anyone at her office would be a safe bet. And if it's helpful to know, she's also like queer and trans friendly. So that's also another added bonus.
Yeah, that's great. We'll put her info in the show notes. Thank you. I think that also that sort of tip of like word of mouth and asking your therapist if you have one who's like a, you know, eating disorders, weight inclusive therapist could be a place to start as well for people who are looking for a doctor.
Yeah, absolutely.
Getting back to the wedding stuff, I'm curious, like what other pressures of the wedding industrial complex you've experienced and if there's anything you're opting out of to support your recovery or sort of ways that you're creating a different kind of wedding for yourself and your partner?
I mean, even when it comes to food, right? Like, I want it to be just my fiance and I figuring out what the plan for food is. It's not going to be diet related. I'm sure we're going to have people that at the wedding, because everyone does, of like people that are afraid to have dessert, but we're going to have like yummy desserts and we're going to have not diety foods. And yeah, I think that's going to be obviously important for us. I think what I know is that I want to get to my wedding day and be my full self, be fully here and present and be able to experience like what's going to be a really special day for me. And I'm not going to let my like any eating disorder voice or diet culture or anything get in the way of that, because my eating disorder has already stolen so many special events from me of times that could have been incredible, but my eating disorder kind of overshadowed everything. And so I think what's so important to me is to make sure that it does not do that at the wedding. And it's a day where I get to feel like safe in my body and loved and supported by the people that I love around me. And I'm going to show up fully fed, right? And like, that's going to make a huge difference in me being able to be present and functioning. Because I remember just like silly example, not silly actually, but so like I would go to Shabbat dinner and I would not be able to focus at all on any conversation around me because I was fully obsessed with like the challah. Like that's all I could think about. Because I was hungry and I was undernourished and I had a million no-no foods. And so, of course, I was consumed by like the food on the table and not able to concentrate at all. And sometimes I wouldn't even go to Shabbat dinner because I was scared that I might, quote unquote, lose self-control. Now I can go to a Shabbat dinner and challah is just challah and it's great, sure. But I eat it, but like it's not, I eat what I want and I move on. It's not like I'm not consumed by it at all. And so I think similarly, if I went to my wedding and I was hungry and then I was around all the food, imagine if I couldn't like actually be present on such a special day because I was completely consumed by like the food around me and wanting to eat it, but being too afraid. Like I'm just so grateful that I'm not in that place and I won't let myself get back there.
Yeah, I really identify with that. I feel like it wasn't the challah and the Shabbat dinners, but it was like parties in college. I would distinctly remember the things I ate at those parties and the things I was trying not to let myself eat. You know, 20 years later, I remember these things. I have no clue what I talked to anyone about. I definitely remember feeling socially awkward. I definitely remember like standing by the snack table and letting people sort of come to me and having little conversations and being like, I hope they don't notice how much I'm eating, you know, and then having people like one person did end up commenting on what I was eating. I remember those things. I don't remember any sort of like real connections I was making with people. And I just think that is, I mean, that's so different from how I relate to food at parties now. I still occasionally have social anxiety and awkwardness, but I also like feel so much more present with people and, you know, able to just focus on everything else that's going on other than the food. I think the persistent thoughts of food are such a symptom of disordered eating that people don't really talk enough about or think, I mean, you know, within clinician communities we do, but I think sometimes people in their eating disorder or in recovery think of the thoughts of food as like a symptom they have to get rid of and like something that's wrong with them. And I just ate, how could I possibly be hungry? Well, I'm thinking about food, but it couldn't be that I'm hungry because, you know, I'm eating enough, quote unquote, or whatever. And I think it's pretty amazing to see the difference in myself. And it sounds like for you too, of like how our brains were just hijacked by thoughts of food versus having that quiet down and have food just kind of take its rightful place.
Yes. I mean, yeah, it's interesting because like now we're in the age of food noise is this awful thing that everyone needs to get rid of by just like taking a GLP-1 or something like that. And it's like, no, the thing that's going to help your food noise is eating enough food and eating the foods that sound good to you so that you're not completely consumed. And I think it's hard because like the only way for people to really see that is like to experience it themselves. And to experience it themselves, they need to do a lot of letting go and like letting go of their fears and their anxieties around it and just really giving into like trying this thing. But I cannot even explain to you the difference in my relationship with food now versus back then when I probably had the most intense quote unquote food noise. The food noise was really just hunger.
Yeah. I think that's so important to think about is that food noise is sort of this rebranding of a natural response to dieting, right? Or natural response to weight suppression. I I'm curious about the discourse around GLP-1s, which has just exploded in the time that you have been in pretty solid recovery, right? The last couple of years. How has that discourse affected your recovery, and how are you like navigating it and sort of keeping yourself sane in the midst of it?
I mean, I think the one way it's affected things is by like now having even less access to clothes, for example, because, you know, it used to be that body positivity was a trend and that brands wanted to be like, ooh, we're being inclusive. Now we have like one size more. And like they were sort of trying to be sort of inclusive for about 2 seconds, right? And now it's not really trending anymore. And so those brands have immediately pulled their plus sizes just as quickly as they put them up. And so I have way less options of, for example, just of clothes that I can wear. And so it makes it really hard and stressful for me when I have a situation. If I don't know if I like, I'm going to a meeting where I want to look professional, or if I want to feel pretty on my wedding day, whatever it might be, right? Like I have way less options now because body positivity is not a marketing trend anymore. And it's funny because I never thought I would say like, ooh, I want it to be a marketing trend, but in a way, it gave me access to things or like that I don't have anymore. So I think that's been really hard. And just honestly watching, and I know a lot of people can relate to this, but watching like these longstanding quote unquote influencers who you've been following for years and years, who built their entire brand off the backs of fat people, only to turn around and be like, oh, I'm going on the GLP-1s. And now like, and then they're like also shitting on fat people, right? And they're like talking about how it's not healthy to be fat, and now I'm healthier and like all these stuff. So, and everyone needs to do this too. And all of you are a bunch of lazy blah, 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 for not doing something about your size, or just horrible things like that. And I think we're all seeing that. And it's really hard to notice that the people that you were following for years and years, who were supposed to be like staunchly fat positive, turning their backs. And hey, it's one thing if you decide to use your body autonomy to do whatever you need to do to your body, that's fine. But I think it's really hard when it's so public, especially after they've built their brands off the backs of fat people. And then it makes, you know, I could speak for myself, but I think it makes a lot of fat people feel like, wait, maybe there is something wrong with us. Maybe we should be doing something different, you know? And again, I just go back to, first of all, if I ever took a GLP-1 with my GI issues, oh my God, That's besides the point, right?
Right. If you already have gastroparesis, that's literally a side effect of these drugs. Yeah.
Oh my God. I probably would be in the hospital within 2 days. But like that aside, and then what, right? Again, the GLP-1s are just a short-term solution, and a solution is maybe a strong word, but maybe some people lose weight, but like then we see that the data that they're anyway gaining it back while they're still taking it within a couple of years. Again, everybody wants to find this miraculous weight loss thing that's going to make them thin and happy. But first of all, you don't have to be thin to be happy. And second of all, there is no like solution. Body diversity is always going to exist, and GLP-1s are not going to eliminate all fat people. Like it's just not going to happen. From the beginning of time, there was body diversity, and the end of time, there'll be body diversity. And I just wish our world would be more just inclusive of that and understanding of that. And now I went on a whole tangent because this riles me up.
Oh, yes. I mean, it riles me up too. And I try to be nuanced about it because I know there are people who take GLP-1s for diabetes or sometimes other blood sugar, you know, conditions like not diabetes, but like sort of off label for PCOS or whatever it might be. And, you know, that find relief from symptoms with that. And, you know, I certainly don't want to paint with a broad brush and say these drugs are bad across the board, but I think it gets so tricky when people are taking them for maybe diabetes and weight loss, or, you know, they have some medical condition that's an indication for it, but then they're also hoping or told explicitly that they need to lose weight. And so that gets tied up in it. And then the drugs taken just for weight loss, I think are very risky. And, you know, the risks of really serious complications are rare at this point, thankfully, but still there's millions of people taking them now. Like there are going to be hundreds of thousands of people statistically with those rare but serious side effects. And that really concerns me. And just the whole trajectory of all the weight loss drugs we've seen in the past kind of come and go, and the booms and busts with things like Fen-Phen, which feels really analogous to like the hype that's happening around GLP-1s. And look how that turned out. You know? And it just feels like why are we not learning from the past and being sort of appropriately cautious? And not that there aren't people who are, but, you know, I think in sort of the general zeitgeist and the mainstream medical system and, you know, mainstream kind of pop culture world, it's like these drugs are treated as sort of an unalloyed good. And some people might have uncontrollable vomiting and have to go off, but maybe you can just find a different one, you know, like Oprah's like special. It's like, oh my God.
I think that's the power of diet culture too. And it's interesting, right? Because you see people in their eating disorders or disordered eating be so careful of every single thing they put in their body. But then they're like, GLP-1s, I'm going to take that without reading any of the research, right? It's just interesting how that happens. And I also have, family members that have diabetes that take GLP-1s, and it's life-saving for them. It's amazing. And also, if somebody individually chooses to do that for whatever reason, for me, there's no judgment around that. Like, it makes sense that people feel the pull to do that in this world. Like, of course you feel the pull, you know? And with that being said, my frustration is not with an individual making choices. It's with, for example, a massive influencer who then like shits on her fat community, or like the drug companies that are pushing this at any cost, or like anybody with a massive platform that's just talking about them with no nuance. I think that for me is the hard part, not the individual making choices that I understand it's hard to make like choices in the world that we live in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, such a good point. And I couldn't agree more about, you know, body autonomy and people making choices that work for them. Not that I would recommend it to anyone. I think these drugs have serious risks, and I would encourage people to, you know, consider those. And if someone was my client, I'd really urge them against it. But like, you know, people are going to do what they're going to do. And of course, they have their reasons. And existing in this world that's rife with weight stigma feels like a really understandable reason to take these drugs that are being hailed as miracles. And like, oh yeah, there might be some side effects, but they're minor and transient. It's fine. You know, like they're so brushed under the rug, and it's really hard to avoid the hype, and totally understandable that people get caught up in it. And similarly to you, my real beef is with the influencers and also with the drug companies and the people on the payroll of the drug companies who are basically like scientist influencers that are like appearing in all the media outlets saying, oh, these drugs are great, they're miracles, they're game changers. You know, meanwhile, they've taken like tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars from the drug companies to develop them, to, you know, promote them, to do studies on them. It's just really misleading. And I think incredibly dangerous to have that kind of influence around drugs that we just really don't know the long-term effects. But like the data that we do have now are quite concerning.
Right. Oh my gosh, my friend's father-in-law, he had a bowel obstruction, had to get surgery. And then a few months later had the same thing happen. And everybody was very confused, right? It had never happened to him in his life. They didn't know what was going on. And then my friend, who's also a therapist, was like, wait, you're taking Ozempic, right? And then they just increase the dose or whatever, you know, whatever GLP-1 he's taking. And then he mentioned to his doctor, and his doctor waved it off and was like, nah, like it's probably not that. Let's increase your dose. Thank God my friend was around, because she told her father-in-law, who immediately went off, and he has other ways of managing his diabetes now and has not had another issue since. But it's wild that like these things are happening. And it's just scary. Like, I feel protective over my clients, over the people that I love, just to make sure that they're getting all the information they need to be making these decisions too.
Right. Because that doesn't sound like informed consent. That doesn't sound like a real sort of like nitty gritty conversation about what are the actual risks of these drugs. And to not connect it to, you know, this rare thing that, you know, most people don't go around getting bowel obstructions for no reason. Like, it's not something. And like, you know, you said he had never had that in his life. And then to have it twice in a row while taking this drug seems pretty suspect to me.
Right. And at the age of like 70 or 80, like that's potentially life threatening. So
totally, totally. Speaking of like therapists and friends who are therapists and stuff, I'm curious, you know, in your work with clients, how people are dealing with the rhetoric around GLP-1s and kind of what you're seeing from people who are in recovery. Like, how is this affecting your client population?
I've had so many clients just talk about the pull to go on them. And so that's a lot of the conversations I have about the temptation to go on them and just really wanting to take them and wanting to talk that through with me. And then similarly to what I talked about before, but just really like the grief around losing maybe role models or like people they've been following for years who are, you know, going on them and then talking shit about fat people, just like really having to come to terms with that and grieve that. So I think a lot of our conversations are around the pull to take it and just having conversations around that.
Yeah. And how are people, like, how are you helping people navigate that? Or, you know, for anyone who's listening who might be feeling that pull, what are some things you can invite them to consider?
I think it's important to share some of the education around it, right? Especially considering informed consent that we just talked about. So really talking about some of the side effects and really talking about what happens within a couple of years and how it, you know, if weight loss is a thing that you're going after, it doesn't happen for plenty of people. And then a lot of them gain the weight back anyway. So just kind of just trying to remind them that it's not that different from any other diet drug or any other quote unquote magic pill that we've seen in the last decades. And at the end of the day, like, how do we help you right now in the body that you're in? Feel safe is a strong word because it might be hard, but just feel safer. Or how do we help you build community of people that you can feel good around and feel like you can be yourself around? And how do we just give you the supports that you need to cope in this world that's really hard?
Yeah. It's not easy, and it's not there's no quick fix solution to it. It's like a messier, harder path to walk, I guess, in some ways than just taking the drugs, right? It's like there's so much more to do and to unpack and like work through when you're trying to, you know, trying to pursue a weight neutral approach or weight inclusive approach.
Right. Oh, and of course, you know, the food noise conversation too, and really encouraging and helping my clients work through some of that with working on allowing themselves to have quote unquote scary foods in their house and working towards eating those foods on a regular basis. And especially the foods that they're the most afraid that they have no control over and really incorporating that. And yeah, it's interesting because I have seen quite a few of my clients start out feeling like they had so much food noise and there's something wrong with them. And no, you don't understand. Like, I'm just different. Like, I obsess about food. Like, I don't think you understand, right? Like, having those conversations. And then 6 months later, a year later, whatever it might be, they come back and they're like, oh my God. Yeah, I was just hungry, you know? So it's incredible to watch.
It is. I mean, I was so convinced that I had a food addiction or a carb addiction specifically, like carb and sugar. And I was just like, no, I personally have an allergy to these things. Like, I was very convinced at one point by some of the rhetoric of OA and the sort of idea that like certain foods are like toxic to certain people or whatever. And, you know, I really like, even though I didn't participate in OA, I still kind of absorbed some of that from people I knew who did and just like held on to that as like, yeah, I have this thing, I have this problem, you know, it's a thing with my brain and my body and I can't have it in the house and other people might be fine with it. You know, meanwhile, I grew up, I mean, thankfully I had an intuitive relationship with food. Nobody interfered and I didn't have any food insecurity, you know, super lucky to have all of those things until I was 20. Like I didn't diet until I was 20. And so I had 20 years of experience of having all kinds of, you know, quote unquote processed foods and carbs and sugar around all the time and never binged and never felt out of control. And, you know, but like that was all erased from my memory when I was in my eating disorder and disordered eating days and, you know, convinced by this sort of rhetoric.
And you know, if it makes anyone else feel better, I didn't have any of those days because I was put in a diet from like the earliest of ages and never felt normal, quote, like just never felt okay around food. And I still am at a place now where I am completely okay around food. And being at a holiday meal or just a big dinner or restaurant does not scare me in the slightest because it's just food and I'm going to eat what sounds good and move on with my life. So just want to, I guess, point out that it is possible whether or not you've had that experience.
That is so important. And I think it's rare to find people who've gone all the way through recovery with the kind of like length and depth of a disorder relationship with food that you're talking about. You know, like I think, I mean, there are certainly people out there who do it and do it all the time and are able to recover despite all those barriers. But I think it is a big barrier, you know, and it can trip people up, I think, when they think, well, I've never known a peaceful relationship with food. Like my entire consciousness has been on a diet. So how could I possibly think that I can get to the other side?
Even when you talk about like recovery, like I see so many of these like definitions of recovery that are so unrealistic that I just want to say that your recovery gets to be yours. It's not going to look like any definition. And recovery doesn't mean that you're never going to have a disordered thought about food again, because we live in a world where that's kind of the norm, right? Like society is disordered around food. So to expect you to be like perfectly superior to all of that all the time is so unrealistic. And so, yeah, I'm in recovery and I have a freer life than I ever could have imagined. And of course, I have days where like a little afraid of eating something or just like I have some old thoughts like pop up. And it doesn't mean that I'm less recovered or anything like that. It just makes me human.
that's so important to recognize too. And especially in a world of so much weight stigma and moving through the world in a larger body, like you're going to experience that and have that affect you. How could you not? And it's, like you said, possible to be resilient to that and move through it, even if you're a little bit like thrown off course for a bit. The last question I have for you is about wedding stuff again. I was struck in reading your sharing about that, that your partner has been a really incredible support in this process. And I'm curious for anyone who's listening, who is the partner of someone with an eating disorder, what are some of the things that Becky has done that have helped support you and keep you committed to your recovery?
Such a good question. No one's ever asked me that before. I think something that's been helpful, I think I said it before, and this is not so much words, but, and maybe some words, but showing me that she loves me in the body that I'm in, doesn't want me to change. And if it does change, that's okay, because that's part of life. But just like really feeling safe, I think was like the first really important piece for me to feel safe in my body with her. And that was something that was her, like that was all her, right? Because at the end of the day, if somebody is going to judge you for the size that you're in or have some problems with that, first of all, it says something about them, not about you. But also, it's impossible to feel safe in that kind of setting if your partner doesn't make you feel okay in your body. I think with that being said, I think this is actually wild, but our first date, I was a little anxious. And then, you know, of course, when I'm a little anxious, food stuff might get a little louder. So you went to this restaurant and the calories were posted for every single thing, like one of those kinds of chains. And I was like, oh my God, maybe this is our second or third date, but like really early on. And she saw my face. I didn't say anything. She kind of just like pulled the menu for me and was like, what sounds good? And I was like, what? Like, do you have experience? Like, what do you mean? She's like barely even knew about like eating disorders or anything about like weight inclusivity or anything like that. But she had that intuition. And I think that was super helpful. And so, yeah, asking me what sounded good, really not getting caught up in the eating disorder, right? So like if the eating disorder voice does get loud, she'll be like, okay, so the eating disorder is really loud right now, huh? Right. And so just really pointing that out for me, because sometimes, you know, you don't necessarily realize that. I guess sort of what we were talking about just a second ago, but like helping me go back to my intuition, like what sounds good. If like calories weren't a thing and your eating disorder wasn't here, like what would you actually want? Doesn't mean you have to get it, but I just want to know what you want, you know? And then also just asking me like, what do you think you need right now? Right. Which is important. So yeah, I think that third date where she like pulled that menu from me was kind of like my first sign of like, oh, she does get how to be really helpful around this.
That's amazing. What a cool intuition. I mean, one of the things you shared in your Instagram was that she sort of intuited also that you needed some comfort around the dress thing. So it sounds like she's very intuitive about your feelings and needs in general, which is so amazing.
Yeah. I mean, she knows me, right? And she gets me. And it's, yeah, when we were at that wedding, that was the second story we went to. And I hated every single dress. They all felt like matronly and outdated and just like, you know, what plus size fashion is sometimes, which is not cute. And I just felt like increasingly more hopeless and like upset with every dress I tried on. And she just like was like, hang on. Like I was about to go back to the dressing room to take off one of the dresses. She's like, hang on. She just like took my hands and just looked in my eyes and like, we're going to be okay. And it was like the simple thing, but it was like, she knew because I wasn't talking about it. I was just internally really, really having a hard time. And she knew it, which was nice.
Yeah. Oh, may everyone find their Becky.
I should tell her to listen to the podcast.
Yeah. She gets a shout out at the end. Well, thank you so much, Shira, for everything you shared. It's really great to catch up with you and just hear how everything has evolved. I love this coda to our first episode where you were like in it. And now to hear them both together, I imagine is going to be a real treat for listeners. So for anyone who hasn't heard the first episode with you, definitely go check it out. I'll put it in the show notes. But can you let people know where they can find you and learn more about your work?
My website is shirarosenbluthlcsw.com, where you can find out about my practice. And if you want to find me on the social medias, it's the Shira Rose on Instagram and wherever else.
Awesome. We'll put links to that in the show notes too. Thank you again so much. This was really a pleasure.
Thank you. It was so good to be here.
So that's our show. Thanks again to our guests for being here, and thanks to you for listening. If you found this podcast helpful, I'd be so grateful if you take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can see all the places to subscribe at ChristyHarrison.com/subscribe. That's ChristyHarrison.com/subscribe. If you're looking for help healing your own relationship with food, grab my free audio guide, 7 Simple Strategies for Finding Peace and Freedom with Food. Just go to ChristyHarrison.com/strategies to get it. That's ChristyHarrison.com/strategies. To get full show notes and a transcript of this episode, go to ChristyHarrison.com/foodpsych. And to get the transcript, find the episode page and scroll down to the bottom to enter your email address. A big thanks to Softer Sounds for audio editing and production, and to administrative assistant Julianne Witasek for helping me out with all the moving parts that go into producing this show. Our album art was photographed by Abby Moore Photography, and the logo was designed by Melissa Alam. Our theme song was written and performed by Carolyn Pennypacker Riggs, and I'm your host and executive producer, Christy Harrison. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, stay psyched.